Good morning.
My family and I are really glad to be back here again. We're from Dubuque, Iowa, where we've lived for these last 3 years. My name is Gordon Lathrop. I teach at Wartburg Theological Seminary in Dubuque, which is one of the seminaries of the ALC, and a strong and hearty little seminary at that. I've been seminary pastor there for a couple of years, but this past year and the coming years I'll be functioning as professor of liturgy, and it's on the liturgical subjects that I want to spend some time in the mornings during this week that we're able to be here. Before those 3 years, however, we lived for 4 years in Tacoma, Washington, and where I was campus pastor at PLU, and during those 4 years we were at Holden every year, and once a year for those 4 years, and it's really fine to be back in the Northwest again, and to be back here. So just those personal comments to start with. I'm excited about being able to work on some questions about theology of worship, liturgical theology in the course of our time that we're here. I guess recently I've been thinking mostly about the nature of human ritual, what it is that people do when they ritualize. Now, frequently that word has got a kind of pejorative context for content for us, and I do not mean any kind of pejorative content at all. On the contrary, I mean such things as such common rituals that we know as keeping birthday parties, how your family does Christmas. And does Christmas is the word, of course, because rituals are done. They are a kind of thing that are more akin to work or to play. Play also is a kind of work, says he, in the midst of his vacation quotes, where you work at doing your vacation. I don't mean a pejorative content of the word ritual at all. Most recently, I've been inquiring and thinking myself about the nature of human ritualizing, and I want to say some things about that, while at the same time also ask, what in the world do we do as a Christian community when we ritualize, when we gather together communally and act our ritual? And what does that have to do with the central thing we're about, and that is the remembrance of Jesus? So, in other words, when I entitled these three sessions Worship and the Theology of the Cross, what I mean is human ritualizing and the remembrance of Jesus. Or, most specifically, the remembrance of Jesus and his cross. By theology of the cross, I don't mean anything fancy. I just mean the remembrance of Jesus and his death. Now, I want to say a lot of things generally about ritual today, from a particular perspective, but as these 3 days go on, how I want to connect that to the theology of the cross, or to the remembrance of Jesus and his death, will become more clear, I hope. An Irish liturgist, by the way, liturgists, Aidan Cavanaugh, who teaches liturgy at Yale University and is one of the great liturgical scholars of the country, Aidan Cavanaugh said one time that liturgists are a scourge that God sends to people who have not yet otherwise had an occasion to suffer for their faith. David Power, who is an Irish liturgist, says that liturgy has a kind of dialectic about its movement. It moves from continuity through rupture to communion. And in fact, it's that kind of dialectic that is the sort of outline for these 3 days. I want to talk in the first place today about ritual harmony, about the ways in which human rituals harmonize the world for us, make it possible for us to conceive of the world as a whole. And then I want to talk tomorrow, though, about how that all fails, how it doesn't work. But finally, on the third day, I want to move beyond that failure to talk most especially and most directly about our rituals and their harmony and their failure in communion with the remembrance of Jesus, with the remembrance of the cross of Jesus. I hope that will become clearer as we go. Yesterday, as the prelude to the liturgy, John said that life at Holden is made up of a compound of tenaciousness and nonchalance. Mm-hmm. I liked that. And then I thought that there were ways in which the liturgy that followed was also a kind of compound of tenaciousness and nonchalance. Mm-hmm. There is a way in which we tenaciously cling to the old second setting of the service book and hymnal, and the very music itself flags a memory for us that is whole and good. And there was a way in which I, at least, tenaciously kept on singing as loud as I could those hymns, even though my throat wasn't quite up to it. As a way of doing my liturgical work with everyone else. And there is also a sort of nonchalance, a sort of ease, a sort of come when you will, a welcome to all that is important about liturgy too. In fact, it seems to me that liturgy itself is made up of a whole series, a compounded compound of tensions. Not just tenaciousness and nonchalance held in tension, but there in the night, light against the darkness. So light held in a certain tension with darkness. There, warm community against the sort of silence of the outside. A silence that we sometimes let invade inside as well and take its own ordered place within the whole. The liturgy that followed was a liturgy in the first place that began with silence. And then somebody took up the word, a tension between silence and speech. We concentrated in the texts upon God's gift to all people, making all people special. But the liturgy made it so that at one point the liturgy was saying all are special, and at the same time, as John pointed out, he was vested in a white all. So there was at once all people special and some special people. There was a tension. Yeah, visually attention between those things. There were some in robes and some not. There was a single voice, and then there was a group of voices, and then there were all voices. And most frequently it was single voice in balance with all voices. Now it seems to me that when I think about what have been the best liturgies I've taken part in, I guess one of the things that I would say that characterizes those liturgies is that kind of tension between what might seem to be very different things. The ways in which the liturgy brings to expression finally a kind of harmony between disparate things. Light and darkness, when it's heightened to its tension. Some of the best services that people get really excited about are candlelight services, because the light and darkness tension is heightened. The light brought in against the darkness. And that very image of light in tension with darkness draws our attention and becomes a symbol for us for many other tensions. The light as a symbol of hope and life and peace, the possibility of seeing each other, of being with each other in warm community, the darkness as a symbol of all the things that threaten and surround and impinge upon human life. Seems to me that part of the reason why Christmas is such an important festival for us, in spite of the fact that theologically we would probably say the central festival of the church year is Easter. You know, ask your 4-year-old and ask the 4-year-old and you what is the central festival, and it's doubtless Christmas. It seems to me part of the reason why it's so powerful for us is because the tension gets heightened so much. There it is, the darkness, really clear. I mean, so that the days get shorter and shorter, and the impinging darkness of that time of year is powerfully around us. And into that we light the lights. Light on the Christmas trees, lights on the houses, like we were going to try to bring back the day. I like to call Christmas, sometimes talking about it just from a human point of view, the midwinter protest. Because we protest not just the darkness, but also the winter. So warm fires, warm circles, an abundance of food as if it were summertime, harvest time. Giving of gifts, an overflowing abundance, a kind of midwinter protest. The tension, however, is heightened. This all against the winter. This all against the darkness. It seems to me that the best liturgies that I've taken part in are ones that have known that and have indeed heightened that tension. Women and men both clearly come to expression in the liturgy, for example. Not just men, with the women fitting in somehow, but women and men, light and darkness, movement and words. In some ways, it seems to me the basic task of human ritualizing is to help human communities conceive of the world and all of our lonely, disparate experiences of life. Conceive of the world together as a cosmos, as an ordered whole, as the possibility of harmony, as the hope for harmony. When we make a ritual place, what we do is chiefly ritual placemaking, especially among Christian communities, is community building. Making a community that does the ritual. And when we experience a community acting out centeredly, with a shared common center, acting out an act for the space of an hour, acting out an act of harmony, it enables us to imagine that is indeed that altar is what the other religions might call the navel of the world. That is the center of the universe for the moment. That indeed the whole universe suddenly we conceive of as so ordered because we experience an ordered community. People sitting in a patterned whole, but not just sitting like at a lecture, but participating in a rhythmic whole, in what in more ancient cultures would have been a dance. To enact for the moment a ritual place, a patterned whole, because of that can be for us a kind of microcosm that enables us to imagine that the world itself is indeed such a whole. Or because we keep a ritual time, because every Sunday after Sunday, We pattern the world into 7 days, and then mark that first of the seven with the central story that matters to us. Tell the chief and central story, the resurrection of Jesus, and the creation of the world, and the recreation of the world in the resurrection of Jesus. Because we, 7 days after 7 days, pattern the days into such a pattern, we communicate among ourselves that time itself then is patterned into wholeness, is patterned into peace, into an ordered whole. Christian liturgy is classically not just patterned the week, but indeed also the day, with prayers for morning and prayers for evening, marking and patterning the day in community, or with prayers at times of the year. Our most notable experience is that experience of Christmas. Because of that, we conceive together in community a little microcosm of the idea that there is indeed an ordered whole, that there is indeed a world that is such a pattern and harmony. Now, it seems to me we find that kind of thing ritual making wherever it occurs. My family and I traveled in the southwest of this country a couple of summers ago, and last summer, I mean. And I've always been really attracted by the Pueblo Indians, and of course there is a people that is still very much keeping alive its community patterning, its community dances. One of the things I learned while I was there that I hadn't known before that's very interesting is that most of the Pueblo communities are divided into what anthropologists would call moieties, into groups that are important for the ritual making. In most pueblos, there is a summer people and a winter people, interestingly enough. And there are sort of clans in the pueblo itself. And you either belong to the summer people or you belong to the winter people. And the rituals of that pueblo sometimes fall to the responsibility of the summer people and sometimes fall to the responsibility of the winter people. But the rituals of the group are always a kind of blending with one way or another of striking the balance, a blending of the summer people and the winter people. So that in fact the people themselves take upon themselves the year and in their dances act out a whole harmony. I've been reading most recently, well, I've been reading for a long time and I keep on reading because it's a kind of holy text. This marvelous book, The Sacred Pipe, Black Elk's account of the seven rites of the Oglala Sioux, recorded and edited by Joseph Epes Brown, which is a Penguin paperback. And it's really interesting if you want to know something about at least one corner of American Indian religion. At the very beginning, there is this moving telling of how the gift of the pipe was given to the Sioux, to the Lakota, and the white buffalo cow woman, who comes to give the pipe to the Sioux that they may pray with the pipe. The pipe, of course, is an instrument of prayer. It's kind of like what in the Roman Catholic circles the incense bowl. Well, it's more important than incense. It's sort of almost the central sacrament to Sioux religion. There's this passage from the what the white buffalo cow woman says when she gives the pipe. With this sacred pipe, you will walk upon the earth, for the earth is your grandmother and mother, and she is sacred. Every step that is taken upon her should be as a prayer. The bowl of this pipe is of red stone. It is the earth. Carved in the stone and facing the center is this buffalo calf, who represents all the four-leggeds who live upon your mother. The stem of the pipe is of wood, and this represents all that grows upon the earth. And these 12 feathers, which hang here with the stem, where the stem fits into the bowl, are from Wanbli Galeshka, the spotted eagle, and they represent the eagle and all the wingeds of the air. All these peoples and all the things of the universe are joined to you who smoke the pipe. All send their voices to Wakantanka, the Great Spirit. When you pray with this pipe, you pray with and for everything. Now, that may have been said about the pipe and said eloquently, I think. But in some sense, it's said about the heart of essential, basic liturgy, period. What we do with ritualizing is enact the hope of harmony, enact a way in which all the wingeds of the air and all the things that grow upon the earth and our mother, the earth, also gather with us in prayer before the face of the Great Spirit. That is, we enact with our recurring time, and we enact with our ritual place, with our experience of community. We enact with our little pieces of tension, which are kind of images of the larger harmony. We enact a microcosm of what we believe to be the harmony of the whole, or what we hope to be the harmony of the whole. It seems to me that those little bits of tension we introduce into the liturgy, men and women, single voice, all voices, light and darkness, festival days and ordinary days, that those little bits of tension are each of them what is called in grammatical studies a synecdoche. That is, they are each of them a little part that calls to it, that images and calls to it the whole. Our liturgy can't possibly include all harmonies. But when our liturgy includes some images of tension and harmony, then those images are synecdoches for the great hope for harmony of all things, our pars pro toto. It seems to me that such attention is, we know ordinarily, I'm not talking about some kind of bizarre thing. Erik Erikson says that begins already, that creation of ritual tension that is what ritual is. It begins already with a mother and a child. In some ways, where ritual begins is with the mother regularly coming to the crib, regularly, reliably, repeatedly holding the child to her breast, saying the same words, creating with that child her own ritual, saying sometimes the same words over and over again. And the child coming to rely upon them, finding its, his or her own way to respond, there is the creation of a ritual place. It is a ritual place where needs are met, individual needs are met, and a mutual need for community and for belongingness. And it is a ritual place from which flows the sense of an ordered world. I mean, that child finally nursed, that ritual gone through, knows the world, and the mother too, to be an ordered whole from that little experience. But it is a ritual where there's a tension. The mother and the child are not the same. They are different. And while they unite together in a common thing, they also need to distinguish themselves from each other, to be something else, something different from each other. Rituals are a way they come together, but also a way they distinguish themselves from each other. For the first place we come to learn to something about distinguishing and grow into personhood is that face-to-face with another, which requires me also to be other myself. It seems to me that simple, ordinary experience is indeed at the root of ritual. Or we know the tension I'm talking about in play. Play is marked by tension. I play hide and go seek with my littlest son, and when we we start with tension, with dividing and finding a place where we're hidden from each other. If the tension grows too great, if I wait too long, if it's a little more than he can endure, then he runs out, before I get there. You resolve the tension in the finding, but you do it once again. Tension and resolution, tension and resolution. And thereby that work of play, that tension resolution, that distinguishing ourselves from each other, that hiding from each other, and that at the same time common act becomes a way of our experiencing father and son harmony, which God knows gives a kind of image of harmony to all the world. So it is with the liturgy. The liturgy is marked by this kind of, by that kind of tension as a little synecdoche for universal harmony, by all kinds of things coming to expression, like at the pipe, in order to express all sorts of things brought into wholeness. John Ciardi has a wonderful book called "How Does a Poem Mean?" But a student of mine this summer, reflected upon at a seminar I was leading as a helpful book to look at when thinking about the liturgy. He says, look at John Ciardi's book, published back in the 50s, I think, and ask, how does liturgy mean? For indeed there is a kind of poetics of the liturgy. There is a way in which the liturgy means the way a poem means. Ciardi says, a poem expresses what it means by attention, one part against another, says Ciardi, across a silence. I love that. Or, Ciardi says, the counter motion of units release into the silence they create a force beyond the power of the statements they make. I think that's true in the liturgy as well. It's not such a great thing we do. But there is release there when the tension is there. When the units create a silence and yet are in balance with each other, there is there a force released which is beyond the power of the statements that are made in the liturgy, in the sermon, in the units of balance themselves. That's the poetics of the liturgy. Somebody once described the metaphysical poetry of the 17th century as marked by incongruities yoked together by violence. Well, there's a way in which, although that's a kind of pejorative description, there's a way in which liturgy is like that. Life and death are incongruous. But in Christian liturgy, we mean to yoke them together, to put them together side by side. Mourning and joy are incongruous. But in Christian liturgy, we mean to hold them together. One of the most beautiful passages I've read recently is that beginning passage of J.R.R. Tolkien's The Silmarillion, where he describes a kind of mythic creation of the world in his own world-building scheme, which stands behind his wonderful trilogy, The Lord of the Rings, which, if you have never read, read nothing else at Holden Village. Find that and read it. But anyway, Tolkien's world creation description is about, he says, Eru, Ilúvatar, sort of the one, stated a theme which all the Ainur, the powers, the sort of angels of Tolkien's image, began to sing. And the creation of the world comes about when Eru makes the song visible. This great various song with all the diversity of elements that make up a harmonious whole. When Eru makes the song visible. But what I loved in there is he has a little passage about one of these Ainur, one of the angels, one of the powers, named Nienna. And Nienna, it says, is the one who sings the lament. And woven into the primal song, from the very beginning, before it was made visible by Eruv, is mourning, lament. Lament for what she knew would happen. Lament for what the fall that comes about in Tolkien's vision. A lament that is nameless, sorrow. Well, it seems to me that the best of the song of the liturgy will always also be have such a lament woven into it. So it seems to me, when we think about liturgy, we need to think about these kinds of tensions, that kind of poetics. In what way? Be more specific, Gordon. Well, there is the tension pointed to already by good old Nietzsche between Dionysus and Apollo. It seems to me a liturgy needs at once the Dionysian explosion of madness. Well, there is the tension pointed to already by good old Nietzsche between Dionysus and Apollo. It seems to me a liturgy needs at once the Dionysian explosion of madness and that is to say the nonchalance maybe, or at least the play, and at the same time the ordered peaceful clarity of Apollo. There is Dionysus and Apollo. Sometimes it seems to me that it's clearly was the case last night. The giving of the peace in the liturgy at Holden is a kind of Dionysian moment. In the midst of the what is on the whole rather Apollonian liturgy. On the whole, probably in our circles, Apollo will have the upper hand. But liturgy has such balances. There is the liturgy between word, I mean the balance, the tension between word and gesture. Liturgy needs to come to expression in words. But at the same time, lest the image of harmony and wholeness be shrunken, liturgy needs to come to expression in silence and in gesture. See, the problem is if all we come to church for is words, what we wind up imaging is the idea that God's salvation, God's harmony, God's wholeness, God's shalom, is only for the mental and verbal part of us, and not for the whole, not for all things brought into wholeness in Him. It seems to me good liturgy has classically been at once words and also silence. The right hand of the brain and also the left hand of the brain, if you will. Clear reason and also emotion. Men and also women. And that is needed not just for women, but also for men. Life and also death. Joy and also mourning. I don't know about your experience, but my experience is that the liturgy is not holding out a big enough image of wholeness when I only come to a liturgy that celebrates joy, 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 joy. I feel like there is not the salvation clearly offered is not whole enough and does not touch the depths of me which are also sorrow and mourning. Yes.
This is brought out most clearly in the Greek Orthodox liturgy, which I attend, where the priest immediately after communion goes out and commemorates the dead.
Yeah, exactly. Here is this feast of life, and immediately the commemoration of the dead. In the feast of life itself, there is this tension, because we are given this bread and wine as if it's a gift of life. We eat it in a joyful community, but what is it? The body and blood of Christ. Healthy liturgy, and the Orthodox liturgy in that and many other points is a good example. Healthy liturgy is marked by such tension. But at the same time, if liturgy is only a mourning, only a sorrow, only a ponderous sorrow, it also doesn't hold out a whole enough image. It seems to me also liturgies are marked by the tension between individual and community. And that's part of why there need to be individual voices and not just the voice of the preacher and the voices of the whole. The community of a liturgical celebration is not just a one-think community or is not just a sort of uniform whole. It is a diverse community. And in order for us to image together the harmony which the liturgy means to image, then it seems to me we need to bring individuals to expression as well. Between the tension between fulfillment and emptiness, between day and night, between this community and the world, between this community and the whole church, between the myth which is remembered in the liturgy and our own particular stories, the tension between the stranger and this community already sensing itself as a community of neighbors. John pointed to that passage in James last night that talks about how the poor stranger should be received into the fellowship. That's necessary for the wholeness of the liturgy. The tension between families and a larger community so that in fact what we do in the larger community has in fact points of reference, balance points with what we do in families. The tension between holy clothing and ordinary clothing, between feasts and every day. But such tensions in liturgy are not there in just some static way. But instead, the liturgy, it seems to me, moves toward a larger harmony. We understand ourselves in liturgy as a people underway, as a people on the way to God's shalom, to God's day. And it seems to me that the little bits of tension and harmony in the liturgy mean to be pointers toward the larger harmony, which is not yet fully realized in the world. In other words, one of the tensions of Christian liturgy is the tension between what we call now and not yet, the tension toward the future. We don't just celebrate in Christian liturgy what is. It is not just the harmony of all things as they are. Christian liturgy also contains within itself a bit of a protest against what is. In hope, that's my midwinter protest thing, in some ways, in hope not just for summertime, but in hope beyond the summertime to God's great summertime. Christian liturgy is not just celebrating life. That's a dangerous expression, although that was used very widely in liturgical circles in the 60s. It's not just celebrating life, because that could mean too easily, especially among us, rich, well-fed as we are, celebrating the particular order of life that gets us on the top of the food pyramid. But Christian liturgy is celebrating life, capital L, as God's gift at the end. So there is a tension between now and not yet, between this world and our hopes. And such images, such patterns and images of wholeness and harmony in the liturgy mean, in fact, to awaken our hopes for a greater harmony that exists currently in the world. Indeed, such harmony imaging in community releases, one of the powers it releases is the power to resist some of the order of the present world, quotation marks around order, as not harmonious enough, as not whole or shalom-like enough, to resist the orders of the world in the name of a larger harmony. Now, at the heart of this, I talk about the liturgy generally as a way in which we enact a hope for wholeness, for order. We do it communally. And as the synecdoches of that language, there are these little images of little tensions which may invite us to imagine the greater whole. But at the heart of that, we tell the story of the cross of Jesus Christ. And we do that expressly at the heart of such a liturgy to enable us to see and feel as a community what Paul says in Colossians, that marvelous passage in chapter 1 of Colossians. He is the image, he says, of Jesus, of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For in him all things were created, in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or principalities or authorities, all things were created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. Tapanta is the Greek word for all things, and it recurs there with almost a drumbeat out of one of Black Elk's rites. Tapanta, tapanta, all things created in him, all things hold together in him. And he goes on. He is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in everything, tapanta, he might be preeminent. For in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, tapanta, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross. At the heart of our liturgical metaphors for wholeness, night and day, men and women, individual and community, feast and every day, family, larger community, this community, the world, and would to God in Christian assemblies maybe a little bit more the two-leggeds and the four-leggeds and the wingeds. At the heart of this these liturgical metaphors for wholeness, we speak the word of the cross. Because we mean to say, we believe that where tapanta, all things, are indeed brought together into harmony, is in the cross. A Native American would look at the cross form and say, indeed, that cross form is indeed an image for the union of the universe, for the two roads that cross, and at their juncture, the center of the whole. We say at the heart of a liturgy that has metaphors for wholeness, we say a word about Jesus. And we do that in order to say this wholeness we metaphor, this wholeness we image, we hope for, this shalom for all things, we proclaim is found in him, in what has happened in Jesus. Okay, what implications do I draw from that? So that's all very wonderful and poetic, but what implications do I draw from that? I've been saying our liturgy has such tensions, our liturgy is marked by such harmony. Well, let me say, it seems to me that I think there are some clear tensions, some implications, and some things I want to say from that follow for me for practical pastoral application to liturgy. In the first place, I think we need in our liturgical celebrations in Christian circles to let the tensions I'm talking about, to let them speak, to let them have larger reference than we have had. I think, for example, our liturgies need more silence. Silence in order that the word might stand forth in greater clarity, and the word in order that the silence might be full, so that by the very image of the liturgy, word and silence, there is an image of tension that is a synecdoche for wholeness. I think that our liturgies need to be more gestural. It isn't true. I mean, we Protestants have been much embarrassed about this. We have sort of tended to shrink the Christian faith, to shrink and shrivel our symbols, so that in fact our meetings tend to say what's really important is mind or ideas, and not the carefully attended to gestural symbol. Had a lady one time say to me, whom I was talking to in Alaska, she and her family had been through the earthquake, the great earthquake in Anchorage, and she said to me, we were having a kind of Bible study class, and she said to me, you know, Pastor, at the time of the earthquake, after it was over, I found all my kids, and they were all there, but I didn't know where my husband was. So we went over to the wall where there was a crucifix on the wall. And we all knelt down in front of that crucifix and we prayed for him and for his safety. And she said, you shouldn't have to use such things like crucifixes on walls. She said, kind of in an embarrassed way. But that was all right, wasn't it? As if asking my approval. My goodness, that was all right, wasn't it? I mean, we have dealt with, in fact, such visual images as if we ought to apologize for them, be a little ashamed of them, because we are implicitly giving the idea that somehow mind is best, or ideas are best, and not images. Luther did indeed say we ought to keep the liturgy filled with images, with the classic old things of the liturgy, the elevation, for example, for the sake of the people, he said. Well, I think Luther counted himself among the people when he said that. Those images are needed. The liturgy needs in our circles to be more gestural, more carefully attended to central stylized gestures. For example, it seems to me a very simple thing is that when we gather together in a community, we're not all reading books. I've got a thing against Augsburg inserts, because the idea of everybody with their own sheet is an individual idea. Our metaphor for reading is me alone with my book, but in the community we're gathered around a common story. So let there be a single book carried with reverence into our midst, where we then gather in a circle around the book from which many people will read. That's just one example of what I mean. It seems to me that the balance, as I've said, between men and women needs to be clear in our circles. That women's leadership and presidency in the liturgy is a very important thing for us. That the balance between the world and this community is important. One of my chief sorrows in liturgies I go to is the way when it comes time for prayers, we wind up just praying for ourselves. One of the really greatest places where this little liturgy can be put in tension and image a larger wholeness is if we earnestly use the image of this little patterned wholeness to beseech for God's shalom for the peoples of Cambodia and Namibia and South Africa and Ireland, to name all the hopeless cases in the world, our central cities, Mrs. Jones in the hospital, Mr. Smith near death's door, to name all those needs and thereby to pattern this community and the image of our hope for the world. It seems to me that our liturgy needs clearer bridges to everyday and to family life. One of the reasons why, as far as I'm concerned, one of the reasons why it's so necessary for us to recover the Lord's Supper as a meal is so that we see more clearly how we do a carefully stylized meal in our gathering. And that has points of contact with meals we keep every day, with all of our meals. The Quakers say every meal is the Lord's Supper. And I think that's a wonderful thing to say. But I think that also has got to be kept in tension with there is one Lord's Supper. And you do both. Just like you say, everyone is a special people. And sometimes you also act out special people. And you robe them and vest them. Hopefully not just the preacher. So also, we do one central meal where we remember carefully the Lord Jesus. Carefully lift up bread at the center of our meeting and a cup. Attend to it carefully. And yet see its connections to our common ordinary tables, to our everyday eating. Seems to me that the clothing for the liturgy is of the same kind of thing. Clothing for the liturgy is not, for, as far as I'm concerned, is not intended primarily to be sort of signboards for symbols, but the clothing is itself the symbol. The clothing is a, clothing in the liturgy ought to be immensely impractical, flowing, beautiful clothing, capital C. And many people wear it as a way in which we all are allowed vicariously to imagine ourselves clothed in such clothing. And all of our clothing thereby under that light becomes festal clothing. And we look at the meaning of clothing. What I'm saying is it seems to me the tensions need to be heightened in our liturgy. When I come home from liturgy, sometimes I guess I am disappointed because I felt like the tensions haven't been high enough. The stakes haven't been high enough. It's been too much about saving my soul or the religious man in me or my mind or some part of me that may survive death and not about the world. The tensions haven't been high enough. It hasn't really been clearly enough the tension of light and darkness, life and death, men and women, this community in the world, all of which were gathered around the cross as a way of saying all things hold together in him. Finally, implication for that for me is to say, I think we really need to let stand so central in our circles. Those central things where life and death are held together, where ordinary life and the sacred act are bound together. And that is the Lord's Supper and baptism and the sacred word. I think that those things really need to be central in our midst. I'll say a little bit more about that before we're done, but that all means for me that for me to see the tensions heightened in our liturgies would mean to see Eucharist and baptism every Sunday. Eucharist, baptismal remembrance, and the word is the reason we gather for that keeping the seventh day harmony every Sunday. Well, that's what I wanted to say today. But listen, as a kind of leader to tomorrow. Problem with all that is, A, that's not what we ordinarily experience in liturgy, or not the only thing to say about what we experience in liturgy. And B, to just talk about the cross of Jesus Christ as this marvelous image of the two roads joined, of the union of the universe, is to forget a great deal. Is to forget, notably, that image of joining together was an execution. And about where that all leads us, I want to talk more tomorrow. Any reactions for a few minutes?
I'd like to say that Carl Jung, I'm a Jungian psychologist, bases his whole psychology on the tension of opposites.
Yes, exactly.
And what you spoke was almost identical to what I spoke a year ago about the tension of opposites within ourselves.
Yeah, precisely. Precisely. And you see, for me, one of the fruits of saying the kind of things I'm saying is that the communal act of liturgy then corresponds to our own interior tension of opposites and invites us to hope that our own interior tension of opposites is under God's grace. In other words, my darkness, not just my light, but my darkness is also under God's grace. Not just my ideas, but also my body is under God's grace. Not just the male in me, but also the female in me, to use Jungian terms, is under God's grace. And we need to do that in our liturgy. Susan?
One place I think that can come to the fore, but holding up the tension then, is with those that are chronically or terminally or maybe just for a while sick. And that and for them to be blessed and for them to hear, you are seeing things in a different light, in a different way, and that is important.
Hmm.
Would you please share that with us?
Yeah.
It is crucial.
Yeah, that's good.
Lloyd?
Yes.
The tensions need to be heightened in liturgy, and I think you made that point so very well. Probably one of the sharpest tensions that we experience in liturgy is in the act of confession and absolution.
Ah, good.
And it heightens the wonder of grace if we can, together and individually, participate in an act of confession.
That's good.
And it seems to me that makes the beautiful passage from Colossians that you read so much more meaningful.
Yeah, I really buy that.
That's where we head.
I buy
now, that's a great as the Lutheran Book of Worship is going to be. I understand that the confession in the order of the Holy Communion is going to be an optional extra for it, and it would seem to me that we would be losing something really important in our worship service.
That's a very good comment. I'd like to talk about that especially more Thursday, but let me say something briefly in response. I really agree with you, especially one of the Lutheran treasures, one of the ways Lutherans have marked attention in the liturgy has been sin forgiveness. That's been, we've known about that. But the problem is that in my saying heighten the tensions, we have sometimes so interpreted sin as personal shortcoming or personal failure or my own personal situation that we have not seen the tensions large enough again. That salvation has become then only imaged for you and me, and not imaged for the whole. That is to say, by experiencing the problem, the darkness, the failure, brought into tension with the grace of God as only my personal sin, I may fail to see the problem as being the social darkness of this community, the social need of the world, the colossal longing and darkness of all things for God's shalom. Now, if making the confession of sins optional would mean that what we're going to do is sort of do away with one of the tensions and make the liturgy Sunday morning sort of more of a joy experience without too much talking about sin or any other dark things, then God help us. Then we've made a real mistake. If, however, what we'll do is use it as an occasion to raise our sights off of just personal shortcomings as the only way to image is to image the darkness, the need for salvation. In other words, you narrow the Colossians passage. All things held together in Christ and his cross. All things reconciled to God in the blood of the cross. You narrow the Colossus passions if you only make it refer to personal sin. Luther didn't understand sin that way. You know, where there is forgiveness of sin, he says, there is also life and salvation. He understands sin in much larger terms than we have. That would be my only response. I hope that the new book of worship is an occasion for the latter and not for the former. But let's talk about that more Thursday.
I'm accustomed to thinking of tension precipitating an action, such as maybe the coach giving the word to the boys so they go out and play harder, or the tensions between maybe man and wife that can lead to murder. Tensions between nations precipitates war, this type of thing.
Yeah.
What action do you see the tensions of liturgy precipitating?
I think the first point of liturgy is the poetic one, of seeing the tensions held together in whole. But at the same, and that enables hope, I think. That's what I want to say. But at the same time, the tensions of liturgy also clearly have ethical import. I said earlier that it seems to me that the image of wholeness and harmony that the liturgy gives enables protest against too easy order, or the order of our days. And I wouldn't want to be more specific than that, except to say, if we pray, for example, if we pray for the people of Namibia, I mean that to be prayer, not just a kind of a secret way of urging us all to political action or something. I mean that to be earnest beseeching to God for his day. But at the same time, we can hardly pray for God's day for Namibia without being politicized, without being formed into a people that would find ourselves acting for the sake of or toward a greater harmony in the world, a greater wholeness. I think action flows from it. But the first point of liturgy I want to say is simply that it holds those things together to enable us to communally hope, to enable a communal act of hope. And like poetry itself does. Poetry itself doesn't necessarily lead to action. It simply contains attention. Well, thank you all. You've been...